what options are there? Is it an English process? Is it a Swedish process?
Good question. So I think probably it's one of those two.
Hello, and welcome to Cloud9Fin, a podcast on all things leverage finance. We follow corporate debt from issuance to redemption, credits from performing to distressed, and everything in between. I'm Jennifer Munnings, and today I'm sitting down with Freddie Doust, our senior legal consultant, and Will McAdam, a distress reporter here at 9Fin. Today, we're going to be talking about all things Intrum. Thank you both for joining me.
Good to be here.
Thank you for having me.
So for those of us who've been so engrossed in the Altice drama that we've missed what's been happening with Intrum, can you give us a quick intro into Intrum and why it's in trouble?
Yes, of course. So hi, everyone. So at a very high level, Intrum, for those who don't know, is Europe's largest debt collector. Headquartered in Sweden, but it operates kind of on a pan-European basis. So it's got two key segments. So the first is that it services third-party NPLs and buys and collects from its own portfolios is the second of those. In recent years, what it's been trying to do is it's been trying to kind of pivot to the latter of those two because it's much more capital light. The reason that it's in trouble is it's basically an industry-wide problem, which 9Fin actually initially identified by doing a deep dive into debt collectors back in the summer last year, in particular looking at AFE and LAL. Basically, the way that the business operates is it operates on an arbitrage basis between interest rates on its own debt obligations and the interest rates on the NPLs that it owns. And because we've obviously now got a higher interest rate environment at the moment, can't really compete with the big funds active in the NPL purchasing space at the moment. So that explains the pivot. And in that context, I think it was at the beginning of this year, it sold a large portfolio of NPLs to Cerberus Capital Management for around 714 million euros. There's now a question around how those proceeds are going to be applied and what the documentation kind of permits in that context.
Mm. And to add to Freddie's points there, I think Intrum is quite an interesting example because it swallowed up a Spanish NPL servicer, Haya, just last year through a scheme of arrangement. And the issues are, sort of industry-wide in that a lot of these companies bought bad books from banks, and this is all debt that's bad, but in a low interest rate environment, it's quite cheap to service. A lot of them have call centers where people just spend their entire day ringing up, you know, people that have taken out loans or mortgages and try and get them on a payment plan. And now when interest rates are less than 2%, that's quite cheap, quite easy to do. And when you have bonds that yield, 6%, I think was what they were initially yielding, you can collect the difference quite easily. But now 10%, it's basically unsustainable. And those services that are actually sort of navigating this environment a bit better are those that haven't relied on the high yield market quite as much. So, I mean, a good example would probably be Arrow. They swallowed up AFE last year, or sort of beginning of this year, end of last year. And it's a similar story to Intrum in that AFE had an old sort of NPL portfolio and had struggled to generate enough cash from that portfolio to buy more loans. And so we're sort of in this kind of death spiral, and it wasn't until they were bought out by Arrow that they kind of sort of arrested that decline.
Yeah. And so it's those businesses which in this environment have not kind of gone down the plug hole, or those who presumably are kind of more invested in the first of those two segments, which I identified, are doing more of the NPL servicing rather than buying and selling their own NPLs.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that for Intrum, things aren't quite clear cut with their cap structure. Can you tell us a bit about what that looks like and why that might increase the complexity of its situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So Intrum has a large and complicated capital structure. It's largely unsecured notes, both euro denominated and krona denominated, with varying maturity dates between kind of 2024 and I think it's 2027. They've also got a kind of largely drawn RCF, which is secured, and then they've got a smattering of private placement notes, which are also secured. It's got significant 2024 maturities. So it's got 469 million of senior unsecured notes maturing in July, so like kind of effectively tomorrow. And it's also got 1.5 billion krona of senior unsecured notes or floating rate notes under its MTN program, which I think are maturing in October this year. It's then got even more maturing debt next year with a euro-denominated senior unsecured notes and krona floating rate notes maturing next year, plus its RCF maturing in January 2026. So it's got a complicated and significant debt stack, and it's also got a lot of that debt maturing in the near term.
What impact does this all have on the interaction between different bondholder groups?
So what you've got here really is you've got short-dated notes and longer-dated notes. So the short-dated notes will, primarily the 24s and the 25s, will be pushing for a deal that protects their position. And vis-a-vis the other bondholders, the benefits that they obviously have is the temporal seniority in a largely unsecured debt stack. Conversely, the longer-dated bondholders will be concerned primarily, I assume, that liability management exercises, so drop-downs and so on, which we'll touch on in a second, could worsen their relative positions.
And there has been a sort of contentious start to the restructuring, I'd say. I think Intrum had placed itself in a way that would sort of play to the divergent interests of both bondholder groups. And I think it's sort of surprising announcement that it had appointed advisors and that it was looking at its capital structure, as has now been said, sort of holistically, was probably calculated to have bondholders sort of play to the company's interests. And I think, obviously, at the moment, there are some sort of suggestions that the shorter-dated bondholder group might want to propose some kind of priming transaction on the longer bondholder group. And we're sort of trying to sift through rumors at the moment that those proposals are being exchanged, and there's sort of a kind of contentious sort of restructuring being worked out between these two groups.
So what is the restructuring trigger here?
I mean, that's the main question here, right? So what's actually driving all of this, and what are the timing implications? So the immediate trigger for the group is the upcoming maturities, right? So mainly the 469 million outstanding senior unsecured notes, which mature on the 15th of July this year. We should just mention that the legal team here at Ninefin have only analysed the euro-denominated senior unsecured notes. The issue basically that they have is that they cannot refinance their near-dated notes on commercially sensible terms for the reasons which we explained earlier around how the arbitrage basis of their entire business model doesn't work right now in a higher rates environment. So that's the problem that they have. And they've obviously got these Cerberus sale proceeds, you know, available to them now. So the question is, can they use those asset sale proceeds to repay short-term debt? Can they cherry-pick the maturities that they choose to deploy the Cerberus proceeds towards? Unfortunately, the answer is basically no. The senior unsecured notes have an asset sales covenant, a pretty normal standard asset sales covenant in them, which basically doesn't permit them to pick and choose which senior unsecured notes they pay down using those proceeds. The basically what it says is that they must pay down, if they're paying down pari passu debt, which is public debt, which the senior unsecured notes are and probably the MTN program notes are as well, then they must do so pari passu across all of those series of notes and at par. So that's not particularly helpful for them. So what we understand, and Will can probably interject here a little bit, is that as far as I know, they've kind of indicated pretty strongly that they're going to be paying down the RCF, either fully or partially. And then my assumption is that with a freed up RCF, they'll then use those proceeds to potentially, and other potential liquidity sources, to implement a more holistic deal involving the 24s and the 25s, which may involve priming the later dated notes.
Yeah, I believe that there are sort of statements to that effect from the CFO, where he talks about how addressing the RCF is probably a more intelligent way of working out the company's financial situation. And I mean, if you think about it, it's what, about €1 billion in cash that the company has at the moment. If you just spend all of that paying off bits of debt pari, then you really won't achieve much in terms of delevering, and you'll still have the maturities to deal with this year. So there is probably more of a focus on the RCF.
You've both brought up the idea of priming a little bit here. So if things don't work out as a 2024's hope, is there any kind of priming or up-tiering capacity?
In short, yes. And we can touch on how a few of these European situations as they've evolved have basically kind of presented the opportunity to, in a kind of opportunistic way, put in place these kind of priming transactions and stuff, which we've been seeing more in the US. I think there's a real chance of these kind of transactions happening a lot more in Europe in the coming year. And Altice is a good example of that. Intrum is a good example of that, where you've basically got these quite loose documents, which have significant basket capacity, which will facilitate these kind of transactions. But in short, in Intrum, yes, they could raise structurally senior debt, basically debt incurred by non-guarantor restricted subsidiaries. They've got ratio debt basket and general debt baskets with non-guarantor sublimits, which could be used. They could also raise effectively senior debt, which is basically debt which is secured on unencumbered assets. They've got a general liens basket of about 100 million. They could also, in terms of a kind of more quote unquote kind of bread and butter drop down financing type transaction, they could transfer assets out of the restricted group, or they could designate a restricted subsidiary unrestricted, using available restricted payments or permitted investments capacity, and then incur new priming debt secured on those transferred assets or the newly designated unrestricted subsidiary. So we think that there is significant RP and PI capacity to do that. So, this is another example of there being significant capacity, as we've kind of discussed on the Altice podcast last week, for, in these kind of European situations. It's also worth noting that the senior unsecured notes permit uncapped qualified receivables financings, which could form part of an up-tier or coercive exchange type offer, or also could be used in the context of liquidity to keep current liquidity within the group in advance of a kind of coercive exchange. But I think there's kind of quite significant capacity to put in place a qualified receivables financing as well, potentially use the NPLs themselves as receivable assets in that context.
And what are its kind of balance sheet restructuring options here?
So, basically the start point is, they've basically mentioned that they want to kind of extend maturities across the debt stack. It's unclear whether they're going to be looking to extend maturities just of the 24s and 25s and do that using a kind of coercive exchange or something like that, or whether they're going to be doing it more generally across their debt stack. But the start point is that extending maturity, reducing principal, any of these kind of money terms under a bond will require 90% bondholder consent in each series of bonds, which I think will be difficult for them to achieve consensually. So just zoning in on the 24s and the 25s here. So what the company could do is they could offer the 24s and the 25s the ability to exchange their notes for new longer dated notes, which could be accompanied by a partial pay down of the notes using kind of available sources as we've kind of identified. And then it's a case of they need to drive participations in that coercive exchange. So typically speaking, you'll use carrots and sticks to drive that, drive participation. So in terms of carrots, which they could kind of, levers they could pull in terms of kind of basically driving participation, as I say, could do a kind of partial redemption of the notes. They could offer security, as Will touched on a moment ago, over unencumbered assets. They could put in place springing maturity dates. And then also they could offer up some kind of participation, perhaps in the qualified receivables financing that I described just a minute ago. Unfortunately, in terms of sticks that they could use to drive this kind of deal, there aren't that many available to them. So they could basically do a covenant strip, which would only require 51% consent to implement. But it's worth noting that given the proximity of the maturity date, obviously at maturity, even if you remain in the stub notes, you obviously still owed the principal amount at maturity. And so the fact that you've lost your covenants probably doesn't really matter in an awful lot. And obviously in the remaining notes, the covenants will remain in place. Obviously these are also unsecured notes. And so usually the thing that really drives this kind of stuff is a security strip alongside a guarantee strip, which requires more percentage consent, but it'll be difficult to really drive that here because obviously there's no security to strip.
And then, I mean, in terms of options for implementation, let's just say that, I mean, I don't think we're looking at a deal that could be done consensually. I think there are too many interests that are divergent for that to happen. What options are there? Is it an English process? Is it a Swedish process?
Good question. So I think probably it's one of those two. I think the obvious form here is probably Sweden. You know, we have the recent implementation of the European Directive on a Preventative Restructuring Framework. I think that's the right term, which has been implemented in Sweden now, which implements the Swedish restructuring plan, which is kind of their equivalent of the UK restructuring plan, which people listening to this will be aware of broadly, which was implemented a few years back and is a bit like a scheme of arrangement, but facilitates cross-class cram down. So if you've got a dissenting series of bondholders, for example, you could impose the deal on that dissenting class subject to certain kind of conditions being satisfied. I think the Swedish restructuring plan is definitely available. The obvious issue with it is that it's broadly, I think, in fact, entirely untested. So the big benefit of a UK restructuring plan to implement this kind of deal is that it's obviously tested. There's significant jurisprudence behind it, and people kind of know how it works. And the courts in the UK are, you know, very sophisticated. And there's, you know, kind of a serious amount of very sophisticated case law which has built up. The question is, would Intrum be able to get into the English courts and to implement using a UK restructuring plan? And the answer is probably yes. It's relatively easy to establish what's called sufficient connection to the English jurisdiction in order to implement this kind of process. All you basically need to have is English governed documents, which, I mean, they don't have, but they could change the governing law with 51% consent to English law, or they could comb a shift from, I assume, Sweden to England, or they could do both, which should obviously be belt and braces. But yes, I think that's probably the sum of it in terms of implementation routes.
So they've got quite a few options then. For our last question, I'd like to tie in the other situation that's on everyone's mind. Are you seeing any similarities between Intrum and what's happening with Altice?
I think fundamentally, it's a question of leverage. You have two European corporates that are both quite heavily levered and have recently executed an asset disposal. And I think it would be tempting to say that they're really aligned, but there are some key differences. So obviously with Intrum, the company faces imminent maturities. It's got notes that are maturing in July. Altice, I think, is what, 2028, thereabouts? So the situations are different, but I think it's really just that question of two very levered companies. And really with Intrum, you're seeing a solution where certain groups of bondholders will probably be instrumental in helping the company sort of navigate its near-term maturities and perhaps delever as well. Whereas with Altice, you're seeing a sponsor take quite aggressive moves with certain asset disposals and sort of trying to corral lenders into some kind of restructuring or liability management exercise, which might be quite detrimental to their interests.
Yeah, I'd say I totally agree with all of that. And I think that fundamentally what you've got here is you've got two enormous capital structures, both with significant basket capacity. So there's significant capacity, therefore, to achieve US priming and drop down style transactions, which we've not really seen frequently in Europe, both in these situations, I think. And I think this also points to a broader trend in the context of, so, you know, you see credit funds now looking to deploy new money as part of these sorts of solutions too. So I think that it's, you know, there might be a little bit of that here too, and we'll see. Also, as we were talking a little bit about processes, you can see a similarity. You know, to the extent there needs either the Altice situation or the Intrum situation need to be implemented using a process. What you've got here is a chance for the newish local tools in Europe to be used. So in Altice, the safeguard, accelerated safeguard, and then in Sweden, potentially, as I just kind of described, the Swedish restructuring plan, both of which, as I say, have available to them cross-class cram down dissenting classes of creditors. And subject to safeguards, obviously.
Yeah, and I just say as well, I think they're both kind of quite aligned in the sense that there aren't very many protections for lenders. There aren't the covenants that you'd expect that would sort of allow lenders to enforce against the business or to stop value leakage. So I think it's kind of interesting that, I guess, over the last decade, we've gone through a period where money was so cheap and so corporates had so many options. And so lenders were quite keen to sort of be kind of deferential and have put in place financial structures that are quite easy to game. And I think that in a way kind of aligns Intrum and Altice, but also a great many other European capital structures as well.
Thank you guys so much for joining me today. That was really, really interesting. Hopefully we can have you guys on again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. And thanks to you, the listener, for tuning in. Please let us know if you have any feedback. You can reach us anytime by emailing team@ninefin.com. Check in next week to hear the latest on the US markets with our colleagues in New York. And we'll be back the week after that. See you then.